This is 40 AM in 5, a download of 40 AM LLC, recorded at 7 PM Eastern Time on Sunday, March 30th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, President Obama and members of Congress announced legislative efforts to end the NSA's bulk phone metadata collection program. U.S. and European Union leaders issue a joint statement following last week's historic meetings in Brussels. Claude Moret, European Parliament Rapporteur on Review of Surveillance Issues, speaks this past week at a meeting of the European Institute in Washington. Amazon plans to build a data center in Germany, and this is discussed this week by ZDNet and The Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Internal Revenue Service says that Bitcoin are property and subject to capital gains taxes. The UK's Cyber Emergency Response Unit is expected to be unveiled this week. And Facebook takes a bold step into the world of virtual reality with the purchase of Oculus. And then finally, we have some scheduling notes for the week ahead. But first, in the midst of his visit to Europe this past week, President Obama took time to announce his intention to end the bulk collection of telephone call data by the NSA. Under the White House's proposal, telephone companies would retain up to 18 months of data, similar in duration to what many keep already, and the NSA could access it with a court order. The president's January 17 speech on NSA reforms had pledged to find a solution by the close of March. And while the details are still being worked out, the White House has asked that the program continue for at least 3 months. Meanwhile, the leadership of the House Intelligence Committee unveiled their own proposal this week. That legislation would also end the bulk collection by the NSA, but it would permit the NSA to access telecom company retained data without the need to get a court order. In addition to announcing possible legislation, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, Republican of Michigan, surprised all of his colleagues by also announcing that he will not run for re-election in the fall, reportedly having chosen to take a position as radio host for Cumulus Media. According to the Washington Post, privacy advocates see the White House proposal as preferable because it puts a judicial stopgap in front of access to the telecom company retained data. But both legislative initiatives would require no more than two hops between a data subject and a target for investigation. The third major approach would be the USA Freedom Act, co-sponsored by Congressman James Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, who had been an author of the USA Patriot Act, and Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, a bill that would end all forms of bulk collection and require judicial approval before companies can turn over data linked to a particular number. Regardless of the current legislative initiatives, Section 215 is set to sunset in June 2015, and it is widely accepted at this stage that Congress is unlikely to extend it. On Wednesday, March 26th, at the conclusion of the President's first visit to European Union headquarters in Brussels, a joint statement was issued by senior officials of the U.S. and the EU. One of the key elements of this statement, for tech lawyers and policy watchers anyway, was the group's commitment to strengthen the U.S.-EU Safe Harbor framework. The Safe Harbor is the agreement reached by the U.S. and EU in 2002 that presently enables some U.S. industries to comply with strict European data privacy rules by self-certifying to the U.S. Commerce Department, thereby enabling the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, rather than EU authorities, to regulate compliance with EU rules. This commitment to strengthen Safe Harbor, rather than ditch it altogether, was key, given significant pressure from the European Parliament and other EU authorities to end the compliance mechanism. The European Commission had made a set of 13 recommendations to approve Safe Harbor, calling on the U.S. to take legislative action on privacy by the summer. The European Parliament, however, went one better on March 12th, saying that it would withdraw any support for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, absent immediate suspension of the agreement. The U.S. has committed to comprehensive improvements to Safe Harbor by the summer of 2014, as well as for possible means of judicial redress for European citizens under U.S. law. In addition, the U.S. and EU stood firmly behind the continued TTIP negotiations, citing the current 3/4 of a trillion euros in bilateral trade among the partners and support for 13 million jobs on both sides of the Atlantic. While the agreement will move forward, with its emphasis on expanding market access for goods, services, investment, and procurement, as well as improving regulatory compatibility on a number of key health, labor, and environmental issues, it will continue to lack direct address of data privacy issues, which had been removed from the negotiating table on July 8, 2013, in the wake of the NSA surveillance revelations. For these specific purposes, the parties agreed to expedite a meaningful and comprehensive data protection umbrella agreement for data exchanges in the field of police and judicial cooperation in criminal matters, including terrorism. The 10-page statement also referenced that the U.S. and EU expect to boost the effectiveness of MLATs, or Mutual Legal Assistance Agreements, in the context of law enforcement cooperation on digital issues. Although MLATs have long been in place between the U.S. and European countries, what, if any, role they've played in the context of most recent issues is not known. At the same time that the U.S. and EU were issuing their joint statement in Brussels, member of the European Parliament, Claude Moraes, who had served as rapporteur in the Parliament's Civil Liberties, Justice, and Home Affairs Committee on review of the NSA surveillance program, was in the U.S. and giving an address at the European Institute in Washington, D.C. Mr. Moraes, who represents London as a member of the UK European Parliament delegation, focused his brief remarks on the Parliament's report, the full title of which is U.S. NSA Surveillance Program, Surveillance Bodies in Various Member States, and their impact on EU citizens' fundamental rights and on transatlantic cooperation in justice and home affairs. The report was overwhelmingly passed by the European Parliament in early March, an effort that Mr. Moraes characterized as Parliament's attempt, as much as possible, to steer clear of the salacious in the surveillance controversy and focus on the future. In his remarks, Mr. Moraes said that he realizes how important the U.S.-EU safe harbor is to the U.S., but that the agreement and its problems represent a microcosm of similar issues in the U.S.-EU relationship, problems that the Snowden revelations have sped up in terms of a possible fix. Thus, Parliament, for all its furor to get attention on significant problems with safe harbor, is dedicated to fix and reform what's wrong and the present lack of trust, not to abolish the safe harbor, even if it's temporarily suspended. That being said, folks should not expect suspension, or even ever so briefly, of the SWIFT financial data sharing program with the EU, as two-thirds of the Council is needed in order to end or change it, and politically, that's simply not going to happen. And although Mr. Moraes recognizes that the cloud and e-commerce will be critical in the context of the TTIP, which the Parliament also would like to see move forward, data regulation should not be addressed in it at all, he added. Before the capacity crowd let Mr. Moraes enjoy the remainder of his Wednesday, he did entertain a few questions from the floor. In the Q&A after Mr. Moraes' opening remarks, Mark Rotenberg, president and CEO of Epic, asked if there was political support in Europe to see data protection reforms through, as well as negotiations on privacy issues with the U.S. Mr. Moraes noted that when the Parliament's vote on the surveillance report was taken, there was an audible gasp at the vote tally, as from the far right to the far left of Parliament, very few of the members could bring themselves to vote against it. And he believes that unlike many parliamentary reports, this one was actually read, because members are largely fed up with delays and misdirected energy, but are ready to dig deep and fix things. Jeff Chester, president of the Center for Digital Democracy, asked if the issue of human rights, if addressed in the TTIP, without the agreement taking up data privacy issues directly, wouldn't this provide the parties to the TTIP with leverage to ignore conservative privacy rules for the purposes of favoring a loose description of human rights issues in the trade agreement? Mr. Moraes acknowledged the concern, but emphasized that Parliament expects there to be no passive or active exceptions created in the TTIP for local power over data flows. Susan Morgan, executive director of the Global Network Initiative, asked Ms. Moraes why it was that the UK public seems generally to be unconcerned by the issues of surveillance, unlike the US and continental Europe. Mr. Moraes noted that, very recently, both the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party had voted a policy reversal on issues of surveillance and data, but that the Conservative Party in UK seems to be holding fast on its past positions. Public perception and popular momentum now seems certainly to favor reforms. Zach Whitaker of ZDNet and The Wall Street Journal both reported this past week on Amazon's announced plans to build a large cloud data center in Germany as Amazon expands its global cloud offering. The Wall Street Journal had reported that Amazon's Senior Vice President for Web Services, Andy Jassy, had hinted that Amazon's decision to build in Germany may in no small measure be due to data sovereignty issues. In this case, given the strictness of German privacy laws and the need for German nationals to know where their data is stored and under what legal jurisdiction. Amazon's cloud services presently serve 10 regions, including both U.S. coasts, Dublin, Singapore, Tokyo, Sydney, and China, which allows customers to pick their region of choice and, to a certain extent, legal jurisdiction. ZDNet's Zach Whitaker points out in his reporting that the U.S. Justice Department can't always serve a court order on Amazon, as a U.S.-headquartered company, to get access to its data wherever it's housed, but that to build a data center in Germany may just give it the cachet of having German rules to play hardball with the rest of the world on privacy issues. He also notes that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has pointed out that Amazon may not actually encrypt its fiber cables that connect its data centers, so that ultimately, any data center in Europe may be vulnerable to NSA and GCHQ data gathering. On Tuesday of this past week, the Internal Revenue Service issued a ruling that it intends to treat Bitcoin and other virtual currencies as property. Any profits made on the currency will be taxed at the capital gains tax rate and require extensive record keeping, much like stock or other intangible property, according to the Wall Street Journal. At present, the long-term capital gains tax rate is 20%, while the ordinary income top rate in the U.S. is 39.6%. Bloomberg News Service explains the impact of the ruling this way. If you purchase a $2 cup of coffee with Bitcoin that had only cost you a dollar, it would trigger for you $1 in capital gains and $2 in income for the coffee shop. Although not everyone may be happy with the tax implications, the ruling signals for now that it's unlikely for us, for the U.S., to look at Bitcoin and other virtual currencies as true currencies under U.S. rules and thus regulated. Only 3 weeks ago, we reported that Japan had decided for now to treat Bitcoins as a commodity, a decision which comes with its own set of tax implications, but is far less regulatory than even the IRS decision taken last week. The Guardian's Tom Brewster reported this past week that the UK government expects to unveil its lead cyber emergency response unit this week. The UK Computer Emergency Response Team, or CERT-UK for short, will be responsible for developing the UK's responsiveness and resilience to state-sponsored and criminal attacks on critical systems, including those systems controlling national energy supply and within government departments, according to The Guardian. Although announced in 2012 as a key part of the UK's £650 million cybersecurity strategy, the UK CERT had been pushed back until an early 2014 deployment. According to The Guardian, the government has been coordinating with law enforcement and the various industry-specific CERTs, including those based out of GCHQ and the Centre for Protection of National Infrastructure. Although the specific location in London for the CERT UK has not been announced, the director will be Chris Gibson, formerly of the Forum of Incident Response and Security Teams, with Neil Cassidy, Deputy Director of Operations and former Cyber Defense Lead at a key government supplier. And finally, Andrew Whitaker as overall Deputy Director, having formerly served as a UK Foreign Office crisis management expert. One of the most exciting tech industry developments of the past few weeks is the announcement that Facebook will purchase Oculus, the virtual reality system, for an announced $2 billion, $400 million in cash, and $1.6 billion in stock. Pretty good for a company founder, Palmer Luckey, who just turned 21. Although the Oculus VR Rift has yet to move beyond prototype, it is widely acknowledged to be one of only a few VR headsets that has the possibility of reviving the virtual reality landscape beyond a spare few commercial industry uses and into the mainstream. One of the first concrete benefits to Oculus, beyond the infusion of cash to improve on development, will be in manufacturing, likely making it possible for the headsets to become much cheaper. And with the Oculus Rift largely seen by the industry as the most advanced available in terms of user presence, the term often used to indicate the realness of an environment, and low latency, the problem that often translates to VR headsets causing nausea, Facebook's Zuckerberg is hoping the devices will eventually move beyond technophiles. Early feedback on the purchase from the VR gaming community has not been positive, hoping against hope that the combination won't change Oculus's vision, which both Luckey and Zuckerberg say it won't. But with some viral videos posted from test demos at South by Southwest showing genuine user amazement with the device, it will be incumbent upon both Facebook and the Oculus team to keep that excitement at the fore as their development proceeds together. And finally, here are a few scheduling notes for the coming week. In the U.S. House of Representatives, there'll be a hearing of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, Subcommittee on Communications and Technology, on Wednesday of this week at 10:30 a.m. The hearing will be on ensuring the security, stability, resilience, and freedom of the global Internet. The witness list thus far includes the Honorable Larry Strickling, Assistant Secretary for Communications and Information Administration, the NTIA, U.S. Department of Commerce, and the Honorable David A. Gross, partner of Wiley Rhine, Mr. Fadi Shahad, President and CEO of ICANN, and Steve Del Bianco, Executive Director of NetChoice, as well as Carolina Rossini, Project Director, Latin American Resource Center for the Internet Governance and Human Rights Program, the New America Foundation. Also on Wednesday at 1 p.m., in the Committee on Small Business, will be a hearing on Bitcoin, examining the benefits and risks for small business. In the European Union, in the European Parliament this week on Thursday, members of the European Parliament will vote on stricter rules to prevent telecom firms from degrading or blocking data flow to their competitors' services and advocate abolishing roaming charges by the end of 2015 in a first reading plenary vote on the telecom package. It has been a full week, but alas, that is all we have again. You have been listening to 40NM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Wall Street Journal, ZDNet, Bloomberg, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. Thank you for listening. 40NM in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, April 7th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.